All right, everybody, we're going to get started. I got 9:31. Conversations are great. Love seeing people fellowship, engage. I just don't want to run into worship. What do you remember we talked about last week? Yes. What were the spiritualists known for? The special inner word. God speaks to me in my heart, and that's all that matters. Scripture had got nothing on that. What about the rationalist?
Not as rational as their name suggests.
Yeah. Reason is the defining thing. Not scripture, not anything else. Reason is the true measure of faith. So this morning, we're going to look at sort of... So we've kind of been hanging out in the first part of the 16th century and looking at the rise of Luther and then backtracking and looking at Zwingli and then backtracking and looking at Calvin and then backtracking and looking at the Anabaptists, because all this stuff was happening all at the same time. And so as our timeline progresses through the 16th century, some things start to take shape. We in our day, we believe in our nation, the separation of church and state, that these things are separate. However, what are the two things that you don't bring up with your family on the holidays are what? Religion and politics. Because these two things don't mix well. And they don't mix well now, and they didn't mix well in 16th century Europe. But we know that while there is a lot of competing forces and a lot of not mixing well between religion and politics, religion, whatever religion it is, ultimately has sway and has a voice in the political realm. While we can separate church and state in theory, we cannot separate religious belief, which form our values, which form our views of the world, which form how we think that the world should work, with the state that says, well, this is how the world works, and this is how the government works. And so while we believe in separation of church and state must also, they also have to work hand in hand, work sort of almost a square and a round hole kind of a thing. Because there's going to be overlap. There's going to be conflict. There's going to be how religious belief affects political law. And so 16th century Europe was... The Protestant Reformation didn't just upset the church order of things. It also upsetted the political order of things. You had an entire continent in Europe that all belonged to the Catholic Church. And then the Reformation happens, and now you've got states and cities and regions that are now rebelling against the Pope and rebelling against the authority of the Church. So now what does that say for how they relate to a Catholic king or a Catholic emperor? And so we're going to look this morning at two nations and sort of the conflict that emerged from the Reformation, Germany and France. We're going to start with Germany. A couple things to know here, things that would have already happened, we just haven't talked about them yet. One of them is the, anyone want to take a guess at pronouncing that one? Schmalkaldic League. Yes, yours is probably much better. But we're just going to call it the SL, because I'm not saying that 10 times this morning. The SL is formed as Luther is preaching, and as Lutheranism is taking off in Germany, he converts Philip of Hesse, one of the German nobles who rules over an area of Germany, to become Lutheran. And Philip, with a bunch of other German nobles converting to Lutheranism, say, we're going to protect Lutheran Protestants from any outside military force. And so when you've got guys like the Holy Roman Emperor, Charles V, who's a devout Roman Catholic and has the army of the Holy Roman Empire at his back. You've got Pope John Paul III, who's obviously Roman Catholic, and has a papal army at his own disposition. The SL is intentionally designed and implemented to protect German Lutherans from any military opposition. They're small in number, but they're powerful in the way that they relate. They have allies in France. They have allies in Spain. They work on building relationships that say, if you attack us, then you will be attacked by someone else. And so for a long time, as Lutheranism continues to grow, as Protestant Reformation continues to take root, The Holy Roman Emperor and Pope John Paul are militarily powerless to do anything to stop it. Because if they step in with their armies, then they open themselves up to counterattacks. And so the SL plays a huge role in keeping the Holy Roman Emperor and the Pope out of Germany. You're not allowed in. Questions on the SL?
SL had a separate army as such? They had
some local armies, but I mean, you're talking about, you have so Germany at this time is broken up into regions. We may think of them more as like states. And so you had the South Carolina militia, you had the North Carolina militia, you had the Virginia militia, and they sort of formed together to form the colonies, right? That's the SL. But you're talking about the American colonies going up against the British Empire and the French Empire, and I mean they're at risk, but they also hold a lot of the cards. Because what they're daring the emperor and the pope to do is to make the first move, because you'll regret it. Because what we'll do is we'll call in our allies and they'll come and defend us. We can defend our cities, but when you send your armies out of your nation to come into ours, then our allies are going to attack your nation that you've just left defenseless. And so no one wants to make a move. They all feel that they need to make a move, but no one wants to make a move. And so Germany is composed of a series of regions, a series of states, for lack of a better word. There's two of those are both called Saxony, which is confusing. But one is called Electoral Saxony and one is called Ducal Saxony. Ducal Saxony is the smaller of the two and ultimately holds no political power in the Holy Roman Empire. Electoral Saxony has all the power. They're bigger territory. Their leader in Electoral Saxony has a vote in who gets to be the next Holy Roman Emperor. But Ducal Saxony does not. That comes into play in a minute. So a guy named Maurice takes control of, rises to power, becomes the noble in charge of Ducal Saxony. Remember Maurice. As Lutheranism spreads through Germany, things couldn't be going better for the Lutherans. They have their own religion. They have their own faith. They have their nobles in support of this and converting to Lutheranism as well. Philip of Hesse is this big proponent and leader politically of the Lutheran movement. And then a scandal falls. And the scandal involves Philip of Hesse, of all people. Philip of Hesse was married to a woman named Christina. And we don't really know what afflicted Christina, but she had some mental, behavioral, social sickness. We don't know what it was. The only thing we know is that Philip wrote in a letter, in a journal, describing his wife this way. She is neither beautiful nor affectionate. She smells and she drinks. And so for whatever reason, probably because she smells and drinks and is not beautiful or affectionate, Philip falls out of love with his wife. But he is a sensual man by nature and is unable to withhold himself, has multiple illicit affairs over the next few years, and eventually meets a beautiful 17-year-old woman in court named Margaret Vondersail. Margaret is beautiful. She falls in love with Philip. Philip falls in love with her. Her mother even consents to Philip's proposal that Margaret will become his second wife. His secret second wife. And so they agree. But Philip doesn't want to do anything without first talking to his pastors and theologians around him. So he calls in Bucer from Strasbourg. Tells him the details. Says, I've fallen out of love with my wife. I've fallen in love with this other woman. What should I do? And Bucer says, marry her. It's fine. Now it's likely that Philip bullied Bucer into giving his consent. But Bucer does the right thing and says he appeases the right thing in quotation marks here. He appeases his prince, tells him what he wants to hear, and then runs to Luther and Melanchthon and says, you guys got to help me. I don't know what to do. And so Philip brings in Luther and Melanchthon into the situation and says, help me. What do I do? Luther and Melanchthon both say, marry her. It's fine. Luther is convinced. He's as a pastor of Philip, is worried about Philip's heart, worried about these constant affairs that he's been in and out of, and sees this as a way to put aside adulterous relationships, engage in a slightly monogamous relationship, and consents. Says, do this. And it's the nail in the coffin. Philip gets married to Margaret in a secret wedding with Bucer and Melanchthon present in the room as witnesses to this union. Secret marriages don't stay secret for very long. And so word eventually gets out that Philip has taken a second wife. And all of Christian Europe is outraged. Bigamy, and by Holy Roman Empire law, bigamy is a death sentence crime. You die for this. Luther, in giving his argument for why Philip should do it, saw that in certain circumstances in the Bible, it's okay to take a second wife. Now, if you're reading the Bible, where do you go to justify bigamy? Anywhere in the Old Testament. Abraham had two wives, Hagar and Sarah. David had multiple wives. Solomon had 1,000 wives. So surely Philip of Hesse can't be faulted for just having two. And so Luther makes his case. Philip gets married. The secret breaks. Europe is outraged. And over in the corner, the Roman Catholics are going, we told you. We told you that if you accepted justification by faith alone, if you followed this Luther guy, he would lead you straight into the pit of hell. And now he's consenting to and giving his blessing to a bigamous marriage. So Charles, being a Catholic, knowing the Holy Roman Empire's law that bigamy is a death sentence crime, sees his opportunity. He cannot allow this offense to go unpunished. If we back up for a second, Luther actually doubles down on his stance when the rumor starts spreading and Philip comes to Luther and says, what do I do? Luther says, tell a good strong lie. Just cover it up. This will appease the weaker consciences of Christians. It'll help them to see without seeing. Philip does it, and he steps forward to the microphone. He tells the full truth. This is what happened. I have a second wife. Charles steps in and forces Philip to submit to the imperial law. And so for Philip, to avoid being put to death, agrees and submits fully to Charles. And Charles forces Philip, and therefore all of Germany, forces the SL to agree to terms that they will no longer make any foreign alliance with any other nation. He cuts them off from the rest of the world. Now, their greatest strength is their alliances. And Charles steps in and cuts it off and says, you can't have any friends except for me. Now, this is his opportunity. Charles now sees that he's isolated and cut off the SL, and he says, now's my chance to bring Germany back into the fold of the true church. And so he gathers his armies. He reaches out to Pope John Paul III, who also agrees to send his armies, and they start marching towards Germany to win back Germany to the church. And this is where Maurice comes in. Maurice is the leader of a small, irrelevant portion of Germany. But Maurice is no fool. He knows the armies are coming. He knows that Germany is going to lose this battle. And in this opportunity, he sees a chance for him to make a name for himself. And so he reaches out to Charles. I will help you from inside Germany if, after all is said and done, you give my territory more land and I get a vote in the next imperial election. Charles says, absolutely. Every difficult battle can be won so much easier with a man on the inside. And so Maurice agrees. And so as the armies gather outside of Germany, as the SL forms their own bannermen and calls them to arms, Maurice secretly sneaks around behind and captures the other Saxony. And raises up Charles's banner, says this is now Charles's land. And so he cuts Germany in half, cuts their knees out from under them. 5 months before this attack happens, Luther dies. And so when Charles looks, as he's gathering his armies and he looks and hears of Luther's death, he now sees that the Lutheran faith has lost its head. And now they are weaker and more willing and ready for the taking. So Charles sees his opportunity, comes in, brings his army there. But before he does, before he really commits to the attack, he has to make sure that his rear is defended. And so he reaches out to France and he says, "This is what I'm doing. You're not going to attack me. You're not going to engage at all. You're going to stay out of this. Or else I'm not going to attack Germany. I'm going to attack you first." And France says, "We don't want any problems. We're good. You do what you want to do. We'll stay out of it." He makes allies with Spain and says, "Send me your men and we'll attack and we'll advance our kingdoms together." And Spain agrees. And so as the SL prepares to fight, Maurice makes his move and captures Saxony. Charles moves into southern Germany, and he is cutting through butter with a hot knife. He is moving unimpeded. No army, no military, no city can stand in his way, with one exception, the city of Magdeburg. Magdeburg stays unconquered. Charles sets his army around the city. They lay siege to the city for months, and still Magdeburg says, "We will not give in. We're not coming out of our walls to fight you, but we're going to stay here, stay safe, hold the line." So as Charles is conquering city after city, making his way easily through Germany, he realizes that he's made a grave error. And he has underestimated the power that Lutheran faith, that the Reformed faith, has actually held in Germany. Because Charles thinks that as long as I capture their cities, and as long as I put the swords to their necks, they will recant their Protestant beliefs and come back to the Catholic Church. Germans are not so easily swayed. And they say, "No, kill us, take our cities, do what you will, enforce your laws, but we are not Catholics anymore and we never will be again." And so, because he realizes that a force of arms cannot conquer souls, Charles institutes what is called the Augsburg Interim. And the Augsburg Interim is a statement of faith that he imposes over Germany. This statement says, it is a Roman Catholic statement, it says there are 7 sacraments. There is such thing as transubstantiation. The sacrifice of the Mass is a real thing, that Christ is actually sacrificed in communion. He acknowledges the papal supremacy by divine right. He retains most of the medieval Catholic rituals. But also, he said, "Look, I'm not an unfair man. I'll give you some things." And so he allows Lutheran priests to marry. And he allows the wine of communion to be given to the laity, to the people. But he enforces Roman Catholic beliefs over Germany by force. He tries even to bridge the gap on this justification by faith that the Lutherans were so gung-ho about. And the Augsburg Interim says this about justification of faith: "To the extent that love is added to faith and hope, to that extent we are truly justified by inherent righteousness. For this righteousness is made up of faith, hope, and love, so that if you would subtract any of these from righteousness, you would clearly leave it incomplete." What's he saying? Yeah. You've got to love. You've got to love the church. You've got to love what Christ loves. You've got to serve. You've got to love your neighbor. You've got to do things to show your love. And if you don't, if you take out love or hope from faith, there's no righteousness. It's incomplete. This interim is enforced over every city that Charles has conquered, including Strasbourg, which was a huge peak of a center of Reformation. As the interim is enforced in Strasbourg, Bucer has the option to either submit and stay in Strasbourg or to flee. And he flees. He flees to England. Any other city that tries to refuse it, tries to push back against the interim, Charles comes down swiftly. And he takes all their pastors and he expels them from the cities. And he says, if you won't submit, then I'm going to remove your leadership. And then what are you going to do? In one city alone, he expelled over 400 pastors and teachers of Lutheran faith. He enforced it. This is what you believe now. And still, the people rebelled. It was their passive resistance to Charles's authority that kept them strong. They scorned worship in the churches where this Augsburg interim operated. They refused to go in, so the churches were just empty all the time. They condemned and they mocked this policy in pamphlets and in songs and in poems. The Germans saw Lutheranism as a German faith, and they would not let an outsider come in and tell them to believe an outsider faith. And all the while that this is happening, Magdeburg stays strong. They are getting weak. They are getting tired. The siege is ongoing, but they are not giving in, and Charles cannot conquer the city. And so what Magdeburg becomes for this rebellion is a symbol of hope that if we just stand strong in this, like Magdeburg, Charles will eventually lose. And so Magdeburg is holding strong. Nothing can break their walls. Charles is determined to win this war, but he sees it unraveling before him, and it's about to get a whole lot worse. Maurice is a traitor to his own people. But what's the problem with traitors? Traitors betray. And so Maurice, having since fallen out of popular opinion, no one likes him anymore, and he's struggling with his newfound hatred among his own people, he wants to get back on their good side. And he sees that Charles is not going to win this war as easily as he thought he was. And so Maurice betrays Charles. He brings his army outside the gates of Magdeburg and says, "Charles, I've got this. I'll keep the siege going. You take your troops and you go somewhere else and continue the fighting." Charles says, "Sure, why not?" And as soon as Charles's army is out of sight, Maurice disperses his army, sends a message to the city and says, "You're free. The siege is over. I'm on your side now." One of the reasons that many historians have attributed to Maurice's double betrayal is that Maurice was married to Philip's daughter. And so Philip, while in jail, Maurice was trying to placate Charles so that Charles would release Philip from jail. Charles said, "You betcha, I'll release him," and then never did. And so Charles wasn't holding up his end of the deal, so Maurice isn't going to hold up his. Maurice then makes a treaty with France. And France invades the western borderlands of Germany, right on the edge of the Holy Roman Empire. And so what this does is creates a battle on two fronts with Charles right in the middle. He is now flanked on all sides. He's got the Germans on the eastern side, the French coming at him from the west, and he is trapped. And so he flees. He is sent fleeing. He escapes capture by only a few hours. But the counterstrike is a complete success. Charles is never the same after this. He returns back to his imperial throne, but he's too defeated and too weak to continue ruling. So he abdicates and gives the throne over to his brother, Frederick. Frederick was still a Roman Catholic, but was much more tolerant to Protestants. And so Frederick issues a new imperial decree. It's called the territorial principle. And essentially, there's a Latin phrase, but essentially the phrase is, whose religion, his religion. And the territorial principle says that whatever region, whatever the religion is of a specific region's leader, that is the religion of that region. Does that make sense? So if your king is Christian, you're Christian. If your governor is Buddhist, you're Buddhist. Like whatever faith is your leader, that's the religion of that land. If you disagree with your ruler's religion, you are allowed to move to a different region safely without punishment. You can sell your land at a fair charge or a fair rate and you can leave. If a city has both Lutherans and Catholics, then the decree says that both are to be tolerated in the region. That no prince or city council was allowed to offer any inducements to convince his inhabitants to change their faith. This was called the Peace of Augsburg. Questions? I know I'm flying through this, but Not long after the Peace of Augsburg settles and things sort of quiet down, Germany starts to unravel again from within. Because in the context of this war, many people had ended up flocking to Germany, bringing with them the Reformed faith, which counteracted the Lutheranism. And so now there's theological debates happening that are tearing apart the German church from within. A new prince, Frederick II, ascends to rule over Germany, and he makes it his mission to settle this dispute and bring peace to Germany. And so he invites Peter Martyr to come to Heidelberg and be the new professor of theology. Martyr says, thank you, but no thank you. I've got other things going on right now. But he says, I got a guy that I think would be great for it. Zacharias Ursinus. Zacharias Ursinus comes in, takes the position of the professor of theology at Heidelberg, and him and one of his colleagues achieve a kind of immortality in the Reformed tradition. By doing what? What do they write in Heidelberg? The Heidelberg Catechism. Right? It's a catechism that becomes used throughout the Reformed faith. It's a catechism that Bear Creek has used for years. It is a moderate, lucid expression of Reformed theology. It proposes a Presbyterian form of church government, and it is still used today. It is massive. Questions on Germany. Anybody read the Heidelberg Catechism? Thoughts on it? Questions from it? It's good. It is. It's good. All right, now France. So, if we back up in our timeline, where was Calvin from originally? Where was he born? French. He was French. But he pastors and does all of his ministry work, his reformed work, in where? Geneva, Switzerland. And so, Calvin still brings the Reformation to France. He travels home occasionally, he preaches when he's there, but what he does more than anything else is send pastors and teachers from his academy in Geneva into France to preach Reformed doctrine. France, the King of France was horribly opposed to the Reformation, and it is in France's borders that the persecution of the Reformers is at its highest. I mean, things happen in France that don't happen anywhere else in Europe. They don't want Reformed people in their borders. And they will root them out by fire if they have to. Calvin is not to be dissuaded from this. And so in a 7-year span, Geneva trains and supplies at least 88 pastors to be sent into France with Reformed teaching to plant churches to build them up in France. Just to put that in perspective, that's about 11 pastors per year being sent from Geneva into France with a Reformed doctrine in hand. The French government protests this to Geneva's government and says, you can't do that. You're causing all kinds of political unrest. You're causing problems for us. Stop allowing your people to come. And Geneva says, we can't. It's the church. What are we supposed to do? And so because of the persecution that it happens in France, the Reformed churches are forced for many years to hide. They meet in secret for years. They meet in the middle of fields and have worship in the middle of fields with no one around. They meet in the basements of homes and they meet in secret. Some churches even require all of their church members to swear an oath that they will never reveal the names of any other church members. Pastors wore disguises. They assumed fake names. If their identity is discovered in this town, they simply pack up and move to the next town. There's a turning point that comes in the 1550s when the French nobles begin to embrace the Reformed faith. If you're going to win a nation, you need to win the leadership. And so the French nobles begin to embrace it. And by the 1560s, historians estimate that up to half of the French nobility had become Reformed. And now, with the backing of half of the government, French Reformed churches can meet openly. They are protected and defended against Catholic violence by the armed guards of the nobles. In 1559, the Reformed congregations held their first national assembly in Paris. creating a nationwide organization for the French Reformed Church. And they established an order, a government for the church. Locally, each church was governed by its pastor and elders. Above the congregation was a district assembly. And above that was a provincial synod, and at the top, a national synod. This 1559 assembly approved a confession of faith that was initially written by Calvin, but revised by the assembly, and it is known today as the French or the Gallican Confession. It's the official creed of French Protestants. By 1561, estimates say that there were 2,150 Reformed churches operating in France. And in areas where they formed the majority, the Reformed churches actually took over Catholic buildings and would hold worship services, Reformed worship services, in Roman Catholic churches that had been abandoned.
Who was in charge of allowing this?
The French nobles kind of said, we'll protect you.
And they didn't have a problem with Charles, the emperor?
No, because Charles had no sway over France. France was not part of the Holy Roman Empire at this time. They had kind of revolted and sort of, this is our land, this is the line, don't cross it. Popes had their own problems. And so what's happening in 16th century Europe is nations are forming more along the lines of what we know them to be today. Where before this, it was all one nation, one group, one empire. They're slowly starting to break apart into France and Germany and the Netherlands and Denmark and others. He does
care,
right? We can't say he doesn't care, but he also he lacks the power to do anything about it. Because if he sends his armies into it, the only way he's going to get it back is by force. And if he sends papal armies, even in the name of saying, I'm going to solve a church dispute, well, you've just sent armies into our nation. We're not going to take that sitting down. And so he can't really, he's powerless ultimately to do anything about it, except just to stand in Rome and preach and say, those French Protestants are bad. Stop following them.
Aren't the Pope's interests divided anyway because of what's going on within the Holy Roman Empire?
Yep.
Like, there's all of that, like, political, religious, like, mayhem.
Yeah, I mean, there's a reason these two guys, while both Catholic, are not really on the same side. Because the Pope's greatest fear is an emperor who has more power than him. And so he can't ally himself too closely to the emperor, or else he risks giving up some of his authority. So the French Protestants take over buildings, they use them for worship, and their congregations grow to massive proportions. I mean, one church records at this point in time that they had a membership of over 10,000 people. This church also, it had 10,000 members, 4 pastors, 27 elders. And during this time, French Calvinists took on a new name, Huguenots. We don't know where this word comes from or why they're called Huguenots. The closest guess that anyone can make is that there was a German word for confederate, which I'm not going to try and pronounce, that the French then took the German word and Frenchianized it, and it became Huguenots. But other than that, we just don't know where the word comes from or even what it means. But it's a word that designates French Calvinist. The French monarchy at the time is starting to lose its grip on the nation. The French king is still an avid Catholic, but he's powerless to stop the spread of Reformed theology in his kingdom. And so what he does is he grants religious liberty to Protestants to try and unite the nation and say, look, I'm on everybody's side. We can all get along. I'm not against you. Huguenots, to their credit, saw it as only a matter of time before all of France became Protestant. Like, you're going to give us permission to evangelize. You're going to give us permission to worship openly. You're going to give us permission to do the things that we're out here doing in secret. That's fine, because give it some time and all of France is going to be Protestant. But this is not to be, because a religious civil war breaks out between Catholics and Huguenots, and it lasts for the next 40 years. What starts it is in 1562, Duke Francis of Guise is traveling on his way to Paris, And he's got with him his armed soldiers, his military caravan. And he comes through this one city and sees a Huguenot church there as he's passing by it. And he sends his soldiers in while they're meeting for worship and says, burn it down. They kill 63 people. And this inspires other Catholic French noblemen to do the same. And so before you know it, the Huguenots, who were just promised religious protection by the king, are now being attacked by Catholic nobles. And so they don't take it sitting down. And Admiral Coligny is a Huguenot. He's an admiral of a regiment, whatever it is that they had, but he's a soldier. And he takes up arms, not only to protect his own family, but to protect his brothers and sisters. He says, if they're going to take sides, we're going to take sides. And the wars that follow are brutal on both sides. One Huguenot soldier who fought in these wars, and there were multiple wars within this span, he says, we fought the first war like angels, the second like men, and the third like devils. It gets nasty on all sides. The worst thing happens in 1572. It's one of the worst crimes against humanity and human history. A temporary peace is offered in 1570. Put down the weapons. Let's just get along for just a little while. Catholics and Huguenots wanted unity, just like the monarchy wanted unity. And so they agreed to a peace. What better way to unite opposite sides than through a marriage? And so in 1572, Huguenot and Catholic nobles flocked to Paris together to witness the marriage between the Huguenot prince, Harry of Navarre, and the Roman Catholic princess, Margaret. And so we're going to marry them together and force them to get along. 4 days later, Admiral Coligny is shot by an assassin who was hired by Catherine de Medici is the mother of the French king. She hires an assassin to kill the military leader of the Huguenots. But he survives. And he knows who hired him. He knows where the assassin came from. He knows who's responsible for the attack on his life. And so Catherine panics. Fearing the Huguenots in Paris would seek revenge and attack her, she and the guy's nobility planned a general massacre of all Huguenots on the same day. On August 24th, St. Bartholomew's Day, the plan is put into action. Coligny, many other Huguenot leaders are all slaughtered across France in one single swift motion. Conservative estimates say that 20,000 Huguenots were killed on this one day alone. And it is called the St. Bartholomew's Day Massacre, which results in a new civil war. The Huguenots are now led by Henry of Navarre, the guy that they just tried to marry to the Catholic princess, and the Catholics are led by Henry of Guise, Duke Francis's son. And it's a mess. On one side, the Catholics join forces with the Spanish, but the Spanish see it as an opportunity to expand Spain's empire. And so if we help them retake France, well, then we can capture them and bring France into Spain. The Huguenots are soon radicalized and they sort of adopt all manner of strange political beliefs of how things should be run. Kings die, they pass the war on to their sons, there's multiple assassinations, there's conspiracy theories. I mean, it's the whole kit and caboodle of religious and political views all entangling themselves into this great big bloody mess. It's ugly. But eventually, in 1598, King Henry IV issues the Edict of Nantes. And this edict is massively important because it secures a freedom of worship for the Huguenots, wherever they exist at the time in 1597. So if you're a Huguenot, wherever you live, you are allowed to worship there and only there. You can teach your children the faith. They can teach their children the faith, but they cannot leave there. They were allowed to serve in public office. They were allowed to evangelize their town and their town alone. But if the Huguenot faith starts spreading outside of the towns that they were already cleared to be in, it was going to cause problems. And while it does seem a little bit iffy The Edict of Nantes is massively important simply because it is the first time any European nation officially accepted two faiths as being okay. Up to this point, it was either we're a Catholic nation, we're a Protestant nation, whatever it is, this is the true church, this is the true nation, this is who we are. France, under Henry IV, is the first nation to say, we are both Protestant and Catholic. And that's okay. Questions on all of this? What's that? It is a lot to absorb. Yes, they did. And again, this is told in our American history, right? That the pilgrims from all over Europe essentially came to America fleeing religious persecution. They wanted freedom to practice their faith where they could and do it freely. And so even though the Edict of Nantes gave permission for the Huguenots to worship, it limited where they could go. There were still restrictions on how they could worship and how they could evangelize and how they could preach. They could do it, but you can only do it where I tell you to.
A lot of local people like myself claim Germany is our heritage.
Yep.
But I had read that we may actually be rich Huguenots that went to Germany and then to Pennsylvania and then to Quebec County.
Yep. When the Huguenots realized that at some point over the course of the 40-year civil war that breaks out between Huguenots and Catholics, ultimately many of the Catholics flee France and say, we don't want to be a part of this fight. We don't want to be involved in the bloodshed. And many of them flee to other countries like Germany or the Netherlands or Denmark or Finland, where they can practice their faith freely from being oppressed by their monarch. And so it's very possible that the French Huguenots go to Germany. They marry some Germans. They move to Pennsylvania. They move to North Carolina. Other questions?
And within them, they could have been whatever type of man that
was. Yeah. So what's interesting in this is that you've got certain things like the Augsburg Interim, the Heidelberg Catechism, all the wars that happen in Germany, all the wars that happen in France. At no point, as these kings and rulers are starting to argue that Protestants and Catholics can coexist and live in the same region without murdering each other, at no point does anyone agree to include the Anabaptists or the Radicals in any of this. Like, we'll agree that you can be either Reformed, Lutheran, or Catholic, but you cannot be radical. You cannot be Anabaptist, you cannot be spiritualist, you cannot be rationalist. And if you are, then both the Protestants and the Catholics will attack you. Anything else? Yeah. I mean, to Charles's credit, he was not a tyrannical ruler. He did what he felt was right. Being a Catholic, having taken the crown at such a young age, he came into adulthood with the weight of the world on his shoulders, and he managed it mostly well. His attack into Germany was not vicious. It was not an expansion of his empire. He saw it very clearly as, this is God's will that the church be united. And we've got these Germans causing problems, and they need to be dealt with. And in Catholic theology, I mean, at this time at least, excommunication and the sword went hand in hand. It wasn't just, we're kicking you out of the church. It was, we're going to kick you out of the church, and before you get to the street, we're going to kill you. And so Charles was doing what Charles was taught to do, what he thought was right to do. Other questions? Yeah.
I know we didn't talk about it today, but can you give me a brief summary of Calvinism?
Tulip. Tulip.
T-U-L-I-P.
Total depravity. Man is wicked to the core. There's nothing we can do to save ourselves. There's nothing good in us at all. We are depraved to the core. It is not say that man only does the worst evil always. That we can even say that man is capable of good things, but those good things are still tainted with sin. Right? That in my sinful state, if I serve my neighbor, I'm doing it so that I can be recognized. And so my pride or self-respect or self-esteem gets inflated if I serve my neighbor. Well, that ruins the whole thing of serving my neighbor. So that's the you, unconditional election. God chooses who is saved, not on anything in ourselves. It's unconditional that He chooses, and that's it. Limited atonement. Christ died for those that are chosen, not for the world. If Christ died for the whole world, then the whole world would be saved from their sins because the punishment would be done. It'd be dealt with. God chooses. Christ dies for those He chooses. Irresistible grace. That because God chooses, because Christ dies, that when grace comes to your life, you cannot resist it. When Christ opens our eyes to come to faith in Christ, we don't say no. He draws us in such an effectual manner that we cannot resist it. P, perseverance of the saints. Once saved, always saved. You had something. Last one.
Brought up the Heidelberg Catechism.
Yeah.
As far as throughout this period, there's a number of confessions and catechisms coming out, and I would assume those were primarily local, regionally localized.
Yes.
At what point did they start becoming more with the immigration to the New World, or when did they become more broadly?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the catechisms start to take on a more official tone. Like Luther wrote catechisms, and but they were primarily for families to do among themselves. Because Luther, to his credit, I don't think ever saw Lutheranism really taking off and becoming an official religion. But he saw it as, this is a way that we can train up families and teach families and educate children on the tenets of what we believe. And so as the Reformed churches start to actually become an organized body of churches, not just this is a Reformed church and that's a Catholic church, but it's big Catholic church, big Reformed church. Then they started writing catechisms and confessions of faith that were for all of their churches. And so as they became, as a movement, more organized, more centralized, they needed doctrine and catechisms that were more organized and centralized. Does that make sense? And so like the Heidelberg Catechism is far more moderate than Luther's catechisms. But it's because Heidelberg is trying to unite the Swiss Reformed and the Lutheran branches of Reformed theology and bring them together and say, this is how it works. It's good. All right, I'm out of time. Thanks for coming.